Alexander Nahamas is a professor of philosophy and comparative literature at Princeton University. He's also the author of Nietzsche, Life as Literature. Friedrich Nietzsche is often considered to be one of the first existentialist philosophers, so it should come as no surprise that Nietzsche is not trying to tell people how to live their own lives. Nahamas explained Nietzsche to Steve Paulson.
One of his major features, and what makes him very frustrating to some people to read and what makes him very exciting to others, like me, for example, is that there is no blueprint. And his general, central, passionately held idea is that if somebody else is to tell you how to live, to put it very simply, you'll not be living your life. It won't be your life that you're living if somebody else says, this is what you should do, this is what you should do, this is what you should do, this is what you shouldn't do, go in that direction, don't go in that direction. He says, in fact, that you can't tell other people, generally speaking, how to live, especially if they are people of any kind of talent, of greatness, of distinction, of ambition, of idealism of some kind. The only way that you can establish a way of life, he actually wants to say, is if you do it on your own. And that is a very large part of what he calls, sometimes misleadingly, his immoralism. Because he thinks of morality, not always correctly, but often not incorrectly either, as a system of rules that is intended to make people relatively harmless to one another. By making them harmless to one another, it establishes very clear rules that apply universally to everyone about what you should do and what you shouldn't do. But Nietzsche believes that if you're going to accomplish anything great, and he doesn't mean by great necessarily conquering a country or killing a population, he means even creating a new work of art, painting a different painting, writing a new book, thinking about philosophy in a new way, you have to break the rules. Some rules, not all of them. You can't break all of them at the same time, but some you will have to break.
Were these just intellectual rules that he wanted to break, or was he talking about breaking rules that might make people around you really uncomfortable or, you know, even hurt people around you?
The latter. And he is willing to take the consequence. He thinks that unless we break rules that might cause great danger, which is more than discomfort, but at least discomfort, you will not be able to create something radically new.
Give me an example of that.
In the easy case, it's literally writing a new book, a very different book from what people are used to. It's interesting, actually, how upset people get when they see works of art that are different from what they're used to. And they really do make you uncomfortable. When people first see Picasso, or they first saw Picasso, they were horrified. When people first hear 12-tone music that doesn't have the melodies that we are used to, we are very upset. We don't know what to do with it. We think it's an insult. We think it's that we're being mocked and humiliated. The same thing transfers to other situations as well. So if you want, for example, to establish a new way of governing, Nietzsche will say, look, whenever you do that, even if your intention is to establish the most benevolent system in the world, say, to free the Iraqi people and impose democracy on them, you'll have to use terrible means to do it. And you'll have to break a whole set of rules and laws and use them for your own purposes in a way that they were never intended to be used before. So think about what's happening in Iraq today. The official theory, rhetoric of the United States government, I think that I'm not even saying that it's not right, is we want to give freedom to the Iraqi people. It's a wonderful ideal. But to do it, you have to kill a huge number of them. How do we reconcile those two?
And you're saying from Nietzsche's perspective, that's perfectly legitimate.
Exactly. In fact, he thinks that's what always happens, except we don't acknowledge it. And that's why, for him, honesty is perhaps the most important virtue, and hypocrisy is the worst vice. Because what he wants to say is, we've always done it that way. We always have done it, we are doing it, and we will do it that way. But we don't admit it. We say, no, we're going to use good means to accomplish good goals. And he doesn't think that is a trick case, usually. Now, he criticizes democracy. It's true.
He was not into empowering the masses.
Everything against that. You know, but why was he against it? Why was he against democracy? Why was he against socialism? For the same reason that a whole slew of philosophers and social critics and thinkers have been against the political and social structure of the time, because he thought it was culturally dangerous. In other words, he saw democracy, democratic institutions, as leading to a degradation of culture, you see, very much the way that people today are saying that the mass media and so on and so forth, which are, in fact, whatever you think of them, necessary for the functioning of a democratic society, that they are degrading the population. Now, it's one year it's jazz, and a little later it's film, and a little later it's television, and then it's the internet, and who knows what will be next. But we always have a sense that the society is doing worse, that it's falling, it's sort of getting worse than it used to be. And Nietzsche is part of this movement. It's a kind of intellectual snobbery, or cultural snobbery, if you want, and he has that very much. Now, instead of saying postmodern society, he says democracy, you see. Mm-hmm. It's his term for contemporary life. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's against, not so much against the specific political organization. There's a conservative streak in him. There's no question about it. He thinks that the societies that created, or the cultures that created the greatest accomplishments were, generally speaking, aristocratic societies, where a lot of people had a lot of power and they did what they wanted. Now, is that wrong? Historically, it's not. Most societies have been oppressive in one way or another. So if you look, if you also have the sense that our time has to be worse than any other, which he does believe, though in my view, not rightly, then you'll say it's democracy that is at fault. But in fact, if we wait a little while, we'll see that democracy has created some incredible things of its own. Mm-hmm. So we all have our problems. You know, who knows why you believe what you believe and I believe what I believe, but we can still discuss the ideas themselves and see, do they make sense? Do they make sense? Well, Nietzsche, everything almost makes sense. He brings you to a point where you think you almost have it, and then he leaves you. You can't make it all a beautiful, coherent whole. His purpose is to get you extremely upset, if he possibly can, just the way that the new artists or whatever mm-hmm. get you to be upset. And then, having pulled at least some of the rug from under your feet, to say, if you want a rug, you weave it.
Hmm. He basically wanted to throw intellectual bombs.
Yes. And that's why he calls himself a dynamite. It's very appropriate. He says, I'm not a man, I am dynamite. It's exactly that. He is, you know, it's inappropriate maybe today to use the term, but he is in a serious sense an intellectual terrorist. But he is a terrorist by means of intellectual weapons. Hmm. And that, I think, is extremely important. He does want people to get frightened because he thinks the world is a frightening world and that we whitewash it all the time. We don't see how much more complicated we ourselves are, how much baser our motives and sometimes our goals are than we don't give ourselves credit for.
So what does he mean by the will to power?
I think that is probably, for me at least, the most obscure part of his writing. But I think what he means is something like the following. The most important tendency or principle that we have when we live is not so much self-preservation. It's not hedonism. It's not the desire for pleasure. He says brilliantly at one point, no, he says, man does not live for happiness. Only the English man does. That's a dig at John Stuart Mill and Bentham and all the English philosophers, the utilitarians. But in any case, what he thinks really counts for human beings is to make a difference, to live a life that actually makes a difference to how others live. It could be one or two people. It might be the world as a whole. It could be everyone if you're important enough. And for that, he thinks, people will sacrifice everything and do it gladly very often. So the will to power is this, if you want to call it, this desire to be different.
Is that to be different in order to do good?
No, it's not to do good. It's to be different because the only way you can have something, to be different is the same thing as being an individual. Mm-hmm. And the only way you can be an individual, namely somebody who's not just sort of stamped out in a mold, but somebody who stamps his own mold, is to do things in a way that hasn't been done before. Now, sometimes you will succeed in being an individual, but do horrible things.
Right.
He is willing to live with that danger, provided that the existence of that possibility also implies a possibility that you'll have other people who are going to do things that are not horrible. Hmm. Right? So he thinks it's better, and he says it explicitly in the Genealogy of Morality, he says it's better to be afraid of man, as he puts it, if in being afraid of man, I also have the possibility or the ability to admire, than to see everything becoming mediocre, which is how he sees the world today.
Alexander Nahamas is the author of Nietzsche, Life as Literature. I spoke with Steve Paulson.